chicken, fake skin, big pharma, and global trade. Yeah, no, I'm not making any of this up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Great to have you along, everybody. It's Tuesday, the 10th day of May. You know, the word tariff has been bandied about quite a bit this primary season, sometimes coherently, sometimes not. Today, a real-life example of how trade barriers work and what happens in the actual global economy. The Obama administration has filed a complaint against China over chicken. No, it's not sexy. It's not, I don't know, cold-rolled steel or something. But the White House says China is ignoring the rules of the International Trade Road, of the World Trade Organization specifically, by putting import duties on American poultry. It's a relatively small chunk of the billions of dollars in trade that goes back and forth between the two countries. But rules, the White House says, is rules. Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us going.
Trading with China isn't easy. China likes to protect its own producers, especially food producers. David Dollar is a senior fellow in the China Center at the Brookings Institution. He says this chicken case is a microcosm of how the U.S. deals with China on trade issues.
The U.S. is a little bit frustrated that China seems to be following the rules. This is all within the rules of the WTO, but it's frustrating, and in some ways it doesn't meet the spirit of free trade.
U.S. poultry producers had a foot in the door of China's huge market, or more accurately, a chicken foot. In 2009, the U.S. shipped chicken parts worth more than $250 million to China. Chicken feet and wingtips are a popular snack there. Here, they're generally ground into pet food. Tom Super is with the National Chicken Council.
We're certainly not deep frying chicken paws and chicken feet and eating them as buffalo wings here in the U.S. So, you know, the sale of these products adds considerable value to the industries.
In 2010, China imposed a 100% tax on our chicken parts. Chinese farmers claimed American poultry producers were selling parts below fair market value. 3 years ago, the U.S. won a claim before the World Trade Organization over these duties. The Chinese lowered the tariff to about 70%. And U.S. chicken producers still want to export more.
We export about 18 to 20%, so that's one out of every 5 pounds of chicken we send overseas or to Mexico or Canada. So any export market we can open up is welcome news for us.
Unfortunately for American poultry producers, it's not that simple. A couple of years ago, China imposed an import ban on all poultry products from the U.S. because of an outbreak in bird flu. And it'll still take a couple of years for a WTO ruling to take effect. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Unpleasant as it might be to think about, the fact is that we are all getting older, every single one of us, every single day. The corollary, of course, is that a lot of us don't want to look like we're getting older and are willing to pay up big to chase that fleeting youthful appearance. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how we came to be talking about an article published in the journal Nature Materials. It's a write-up of something called second skin that can, the team of scientists slash investors say, treat a variety of actual medical skin conditions and, oh, by the way, make the bags under your eyes all but disappear. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is on that one.
Beauty's only skin deep. It's in the eye of the beholder, blah, blah, blah. It's also big business.
I actually got a bunch of emails last night.
Ruth Tedaldi, a dermatologist in the Boston suburb, says already patients are interested in second skin. About 95% of her practice these days is cosmetic, and she sold and helped test an earlier version of this product a couple years ago.
It's not something that you're going to put on and look like you've had a facelift. That's not what the product is.
Tedaldi said the earlier version was expensive and hard to apply, and a topical skin-like coating. It's not fixing wrinkles so much as helping to hide them.
The coach turns back into the pumpkin when you take it off.
More promising, she said, is the idea that this second skin could be a delivery system for skin treatments. And that appears to be where Olivo and Living Proof, the two companies behind the science, are heading. They've built on the earlier version and are moving into clinical trials, testing its ability to deliver drugs to treat different skin diseases. Developing something with both cosmetic and medical uses, that's something of a, I don't know, sweet spot?
Sweet spot is putting it mildly.
David Polsky is a dermatology professor at the New York University School of Medicine.
Jackpot, I think, is closer to what the potential would be. But, you know, a lot more testing needs to be done to see if it's going to pan out.
The scientists will be seeking FDA approval, but they don't yet have a timeline. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Quick correction before we go on. Now, we said yesterday in a story about North Carolina's bathroom bill that Michael Jordan, the owner of Charlotte's NBA franchise, the Hornets, would move the team out of the state if the law wasn't overturned. We were wrong about that. The number of the day today is denominated in percentages, 1.25% to be precise. Go ahead, guess. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. When you think of industries, big industries, I mean, there are really only a couple that are so big they get big as an honorific of sorts. Big oil, big tobacco, also big pharma. GlaxoSmithKline is one of that number, one of the big pharmaceutical companies in the global economy. The company's CEO, Sir Andrew Witty, is today's guest on Conversations from the Corner Office. Thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Great to meet you.
You've been in pharmaceuticals a long time, 30-something years. And I wonder, through all the ups and downs, whether with Valeant, the company that's in a whole lot of trouble, and Martin Shkreli, the guy who bought the patent and jacked up the prices, and with the pressure from Congress about consumer prices on pharmaceuticals, I wonder if this is the roughest maybe that you've ever seen it.
It's certainly a period of extreme challenge. A lot of critics around, obviously. I would put it slightly differently.
Okay.
I also think this is telling us things have to change. People are concerned about affordability of healthcare overall. Meanwhile, pharmaceutical companies, thousands and thousands of scientists are working every single day to try and come up with the next great breakthroughs. That's a good thing. We've got to find a way to get these things to sync back together so that people can be confident that they're going to get the treatments and the cures that they're hoping and praying for. We've got to work harder to make that happen.
There is a lot in that answer to unpack. So first of all, let's talk pricing. I mean, you are in a position where you can do something about this. What specifically are you doing? What do you have in mind that will make vital medications and pharmaceuticals more affordable for people who need them?
Well, at GSK, we've already been working on this. So for the last 7 or 8 years, we've spent a lot of time trying to reduce the costs of our R&D operations to try and make it less expensive to find these medicines. The problem in the U.S., bluntly speaking, is there's no transparency around what the real prices of everything is. We need to do something about that because we need to know what the real price is so we can figure out what the real cost benefit is to the system. And I personally think there's an overdue opportunity for stakeholders in the system, private and government, to be sitting together to think about what is the regulatory reform that's needed here in the US to make it easier for this market to innovate and create competition in the marketplace.
You talked about R&D a little bit and how you're working to cut costs in R&D. How are you doing that and how is that translating into what I have to pay when I go to the drugstore?
Right. So the number one thing, and not to sound too simplistic about it, is the best way to reduce costs of pharmaceutical R&D is to fail less often. R&D in pharmaceuticals is incredibly difficult. A lot of people compare it to putting man on the moon. At least we can see the moon. You know, unfortunately, in pharmaceuticals, we're dealing with things you can't see. It's incredibly complex. And the amount of failure in this regard is inevitably enormous. So if we can find ways to reduce the amount of failure, then the price of or the cost of the successes goes down.
Does it make sense to you that consumers have to pay for your failures?
I think inevitably somebody has to pay for the failures, I'm afraid. I know it sounds weird, but to give you a real example, we're working diligently on Alzheimer's disease. I think everybody in America knows that's an area we need to make progress. But really, nobody even today knows what the true cause of Alzheimer's is. There's no good animal model to experiment in before you go to humans. That's what we're trying to navigate. That's why failure is inevitable. If you want a shareholder to invest in a high-risk project which might well fail, then they have to be confident that somehow there's going to be a compensation at the end.
You talked about systemic change earlier and how that's really what we need to solve this conundrum of the cost of drugs. Seems to me that you, as a guy who's been in this business for 30 years, who's on his way out, right? You're retiring next March or whatever it is. You could stand up and jump up and down on your desk and people would listen. Why aren't you doing that?
Well, I guess I'm not jumping up and down on my desk, but I'm certainly speaking out. And for me, pricing, value for money, and innovation are the next frontier for us to really resolve. But it's those three things together. We need innovation. We have to give you value for money. We have to be grown up about pricing. We have to be working to balance the needs of the owners of companies and the patients and the users of the medicine.
Andrew Woody is the chief executive at GlaxoSmithKline. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Mr. Woody and I went about 15 minutes or so. You can hear the whole thing on our Corner Office podcast. It is available, of course, wherever you choose to get your podcasts. We try to eat healthy, right? Most of us pay at least passing attention to nutritional values and what the recommended daily allowances are. It takes a little work, a little diligence, but we do it, even though the Food and Drug Administration can make it tricky. According to current FDA guidelines, just for instance, some sugary cereals could be called healthy, but some foods containing nuts can't. Nuts apparently can mean a food is too high in fat to be considered healthy, which is nuts, if you think about it. I am happy to be able to tell you then that the FDA agrees. It released a statement today saying it's reevaluating, quote, regulations concerning nutrient content claims, end of quote, that include the term healthy. Marketplace's Sally Herships reports that government labels like healthy might just need this marketing makeover to keep their public health value.
The past several versions of dietary guidelines have told us to eat foods like nuts and seeds because they're good for us. But those same foods are high in fat, and the FDA's regulations limit how much fat we should eat, which means...
Under the current regulations, you couldn't call an avocado healthy. You couldn't call an almond or a walnut healthy. You couldn't call wild salmon healthy.
Oh, bureaucracy. Dr. David Katz is founder and director of the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center. He says these regulations are not only at odds with the government's own advice, they're also just wrong. And he says there's another problem.
The regulations that FDA has now not only preclude calling almonds and walnuts and avocados healthy, but they would allow for calling some things that we know to be junk healthy.
Katz says updating the definition of healthy will help consumers to be healthier and businesses to sell healthier food. And the FDA says now seems like a good time to reevaluate. Emily Balsamo is an analyst with the research firm Euromonitor International. But she says even if the FDA does update its definition of healthy,
Americans are overwhelmingly not taking their nutritional wisdom from the government.
She says public distrust of the government's guidance on food has become part of the public consciousness.
Nowadays, when Americans look at an ingredients list and it's, you know, 50 lines long, a red light goes off, and it doesn't matter if it's low in fat or low in calories.
Balsamo says consumers don't trust big businesses either. Big food companies are losing share to smaller ones. So she says the government doesn't just need to update its definition of healthy. It also needs to work on regaining consumer trust. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's a very important relationship and one that I think we don't talk about very much here in the U.S.
One would be tempted to say China. One would be wrong. Well, half wrong anyway. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 222 points. 222 points. 1.25% closed at 17,928. The NASDAQ gained 59 points. 1.25% finished at 4809. The S&P 525 points higher. Here you go. 1.25% ended at 2,084. Slight rise in the price of oil helped boost energy stocks. Chevron added 0.9%. ExxonMobil up 1.6% today. Gap tripped down more than 11% after the company reported weaker sales. For those keeping track, the number is 5. 5 what? I hear you screaming at your radio. 5 straight quarters of declining sales. That's what. Bond price is basically flat. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note remained at 1.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Retail is hard. Straight up, old-fashioned, selling stuff to people face-to-face, retail is the subject here. And those companies are having to make some tough choices. Where to open or close stores, what to put in them even, because you can get what you want, when you want, delivered where you are at the click of a mouse nowadays, right? We sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman out from the cozy confines of our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting to figure out what specific incarnations of brick-and-mortar retail might survive, dare one say thrive.
Why do retailers even bother having stores in malls or on Main Street anymore, with all the added costs of real estate and fancy displays, sales staff, and inventory?
Consumers do shop differently in stores. They tend to make more impulse purchases, and the longer they're in a shopping environment, the more money they're likely to spend.
Golden Gate University psychologist Kit Yarrow does these fly-on-the-wall shadow shopping trips with consumers. She says if you're a retailer, you want real live consumers walking through actual stores being served.
They also have the pressure of somebody helping them, which a lot of times creates this sense of obligation, and it can result in a more immediate purchase with less shopping around.
And even as many store chains struggle under the online retail onslaught, some major retailers are thriving in this new multi-channel brick-and-mortar plus e-commerce environment.
The couch is deeper than the love seat.
I can't remark on that. I don't know why that would be.
I'm at the giant IKEA store in Portland, Oregon. Admittedly, all IKEA stores are giant. This one's at a new outdoor mall by the airport. Alessandra Zinni, originally from Italy, is the store manager. We're drinking coffee in the busy customer cafeteria, and she has the Swedish company's strategy mantra down pat.
Being the multi-channel leader in life at home.
Multi-channel leader, life at home. What does all that mean? Well, for starters, the company, which was late to the online sales game, is now aggressively expanding both its website and its network of megastores across the country. And IKEA's experimenting with retail modes in between, click-and-collect pickup sites for online sales, an interactive platform to do home design on the web. Meanwhile, Zinni says store traffic is actually up.
The reason why the customer will continue to come to our store? Inspiration. We are not imagining an online website that can give you the inspiration that we can create by showing a room setting.
Another strategic advantage for IKEA, demographics. They're catering to web-savvy millennials who need affordable furniture to fit into their tiny, unaffordable apartments. And exclusivity. Only IKEA sells IKEA furniture, so they don't have to battle against people comparison shopping for the lowest price online. Plus, IKEA's a destination.
When you come to the store, you want to have a fun day out for the entire family. We have a kids area. We have a restaurant.
Those Swedish meatballs doused in lingonberry sauce.
Food is finding its way into everything.
Herb Heiserman is an architect and designer and principal with the retail development firm Street Sense in suburban Maryland.
And I'm not saying that you're going to have a whole restaurant in a J.Crew store, but you're seeing a combination of retailing and food offering environments that extend the stay of the customer.
Heiserman says retail chains are desperately trying to figure out how to keep at least some of their stores open in major metro areas, in upscale destination malls, and hip urban neighborhoods where their brand will be seen and noticed.
People still need a home base, still need a touchdown and connect with the brand itself. And I don't believe you get that 100% online.
But he says many retailers simply don't have enough in-store sales anymore to keep all of their locations open. The stores that are left will increasingly offer experience more than inventory. Heiserman points to the up-and-coming men's clothing brand Bonobos, where you go not to a store but to a guide shop that stocks one of every size and color just to try on.
you're really going into a billboard for the store, designed very nicely, a nice experience, but you're not coming home with the product. These retailers are going to go towards distribution centers, not unlike Amazon, rather than seeing it online, but you're going and touching it and feeling it and sitting in it, and then it comes to your door.
All of which means there's probably going to be a lot of empty retail real estate in malls and on main streets across America in coming years. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We were talking China earlier, the trade battle that's been joined over chicken feet in part. Apologies for the mixing of the metaphors here, but that's not even the tip of the iceberg and involves only one of the Asian economies that's going to help determine our collective futures. China is the biggie, of course, but India is not far behind, and we're all going to have to figure out how to get along if we want the global economy to work the way we all think we want it to. That is the point former State Department official Anya Manuel makes in her new book. It's called This Brave New World, India, China, and the United States. Anya, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai.
Give me some sense of timing here, would you, before the Brave New World is upon us, I guess?
It's a good question. You know, China and India are already having a dramatic impact on the United States, and they will continue to do so, and increasingly so, over the next decade. Within that time, they're going to be the fastest growing market for our companies, with 3 billion people between them and the world's biggest middle classes. Hmm. So you can see how important it is to get it right and to get it right on those relationships with both countries right now.
This is a remarkably sensible book. And I wonder how you look at
Thank
the
you.
American. You're welcome. But here's the question that follows the compliment. How do you view the American political discussion of China, which is almost invariably one of fear and one of antagonism?
One of the reasons I started on this book project is because I think our public discourse, especially on China, is so off. They're growing. They're struggling with internal issues, just like we are. They want prosperous lives and good schools for their kids, just like we do. And India, even though it is about to be the third largest economy on Earth, with 100 million more people than China by 2030, the largest middle class on Earth, we largely ignore it. It's almost not present in our public discourse.
This is a tripartite relationship that you write about, but you do spend some time talking about the bilateral relationship between India and China. How important a fulcrum is that in this entire discussion?
It's a very important relationship and one that I think we don't talk about very much here in the U.S. And they've had good relations over the years. There's a lot of trade back and forth, but increasingly India is worried about China, just like we are worried about China. On the military side, you have some skirmishes up on the high Himalayan borders. There are Chinese submarines sneaking through Indian waters. So really, just in the last 5 years, India has gone from being very sanguine about China to a little bit worried.
Okay, so India's worried about China and we're worried about China. Are the Chinese worried about either of us?
I think the Chinese are... Here, they're often portrayed as an unstoppable juggernaut.
Yeah.
One day, and the next day, it's the doomed dragon The economy is collapsing. We can't seem to decide which one it is. I think the Chinese are really worried about their domestic situation, and they're in a defensive crouch in a weird way, similar to how we are here in the U.S. Hmm. You know, they have a big economic change that they have to get right. There were reports a couple weeks ago that they're about to lay off 5 million people in the coal and steel industries alone. Now, our manufacturing sector is suffering. So is some of theirs. So they're worried, and they're not worried, I think, because they feel threatened by us. They're worried because they have to get their internal system exactly right.
You raise this hypothetically in the book, but let me put the actual question to you. Should we in the United States be rooting for these countries to fail in their rise to economic and geopolitical prominence?
No, absolutely not. Like it or not, they are the engine of economic growth for the United States. China is already America's fastest growing export market. We're talking a lot about jobs, moving overseas to China and India and elsewhere. That's true, but our exports to those countries are also creating lots of good jobs at home. If you look at Boeing, for example, more than a quarter of its commercial planes are sold to China and India alone. If those markets are closed to us, we're going to be laying off tens of thousands of Americans. So those are just two reasons why we should want them to succeed and why it's in our interest for them to do so.
It's called This Brave New World, India, China, and the United States by Anya Manuel. Anya, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
This final note on the way out today, in which black becomes the new blue. Some of you may have noticed this the past couple of days. Google has been playing around with the color of the links that it returns search results in. If you're outraged, get in line. Links are supposed to be blue. We all know that. A Google spokesperson says merely, "We're always running many small-scale experiments with the design of the results page." Mark me down as a no, yo. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks so much for listening to Marketplace. You hear me do the numbers every day, but we aim to bring you more than the numbers. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. We'd like you to help keep our numbers strong by making a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace. And this month, your gift in any amount is going to be automatically doubled thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. So please donate today at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 222 points today, 1.25%. The S&P 500 up 59 points. Sorry, the NASDAQ up 59. The S&P 500 up 25. I was waiting for the punchline about 1.25%, but I blew that one. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwood, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.